tonight's program. War on Sacred Grounds is the program, and we're very pleased to have with us this evening Ron Hassner, Professor of Political Science at the University of California in Berkeley. Tonight's event is sponsored, as you know, by the World Affairs Council's Young Professional International Forum. I'm Chuck Frankel. I'm trustee for the World Affairs Council board. I'm on the board. For those of you who may be new to the organization, the World Affairs Council was established in 1947 to engage the public in the exploration of issues and opportunities that transcend borders. If you'd like to learn more about this organization, and I hope you will, please visit our website, itsyourworld.org, and the Young Professionals Organization, the Young Professional International Forum, is known as IF. It's a volunteer subcommittee of the World Affairs Council. It was founded to promote the involvement of younger council members. The IF creates programs and it organizes social and cultural events that provide an environment for younger people. And the younger people obviously have international interests and hope to meet and share experiences. There are several members of the IF here tonight. I know their president, Philip Sain, is here, and we thank them for helping to organize tonight's meeting. Before we begin, it would be much appreciated if you could silence all your cell phones and anything else that might interrupt the program. Please also take note of the blue cards on the seat. They're for questions, and I would encourage you to write short and clear questions for our speaker. The council staff will come by to collect them, and I will seek to ask your questions. Finally, let me announce two upcoming International Forum events that might be of interest to you. Next week, Tuesday, June 1st, join the IF for its monthly steering committee meeting where international current affairs are explored through informal discussion groups. And they also plan the council events such as this one this evening. It's an opportunity to get in the middle of it. We encourage you to join us for the meeting. It'll be held here at the council at 6:30, Tuesday, June 1st. Then on Friday, June the 4th, the IF will feature Pashal Iwu, the president and CEO of the Africa Network, to discuss innovation and entrepreneurship across the African continent. The event will include a reception with African music, food and drinks. It will also be held here at the World Affairs Council Auditorium, 6 p.m., June 4th. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished guest. Ron Hassner is Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley. He is also co-director of Berkeley's Religion, Politics, and Globalization Program. Previously, Dr. Hassner was a postdoctoral scholar at the Olin Institute for International Security at Harvard University, as well as a visiting professor at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. Professor Hassner's research revolves around symbolic and emotive aspects of international security, with particular attention to religious violence, Middle Eastern politics, and territorial disputes. His most recent book, War on Sacred Grounds, examines the causes and characteristics of disputes over sacred places and analyzes the conditions under which these conflicts can be managed. Here tonight to offer insight into these often violent dynamics that come into play at the places where religion and politics collide, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Professor Ron Hassner.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming. Thank you for inviting me to talk about my book, a large image of which is about to appear. There we go. We'll skip it. Even better. Let me start with this story, which takes place not too far from the Grand Canyon in what is the largest Native American reservation in the United States, the Navajo Reservation. That reservation is of interest to me in part because it is at the core of a territorial dispute between three Native American tribes, the Hopi, the Navajo, and the Paiute. The Hopi sit right there in the green area on the side. The Navajo have rights in the entire reservation. The Paiute are sort of distributed in the region. It's a particularly rough dispute over the area here encircled because in it are the Echo Cliffs, a space sacred to all three tribes, particularly to the Hopi and the Paiute, who worship the golden eagles who reside in these Echo Cliffs. To both these tribes, these eagles are sacred. To the Hopi, they are messengers of the gods. The Paiute consider them to be gods themselves. And so the Paiute do everything they can to preserve these eagles from harm. The Hopi, on the other hand, who see them as messengers of the gods, tend to steal the baby eagles from their nests, tie them to the roofs of their huts so that the baby eagles can observe day-to-day life in a Hopi village. And then in midsummer, at the most important Hopi ceremony of the year, the Niman ceremony, members of the Hopi tribe strangle the eagles to death. You can see, I think, why the Hopi and the Paiute don't get along so well. I'm telling you the story, I guess, for three reasons. First, to underline the fact that you don't have to travel to the Middle East to encounter disputes over sacred space. The second reason I'm telling you the story is to make it very clear that I am pessimistic about the resolution of territorial disputes, and I think that'll become obvious to you in the next 25 minutes or so. In response to the events of 9/11, there was at first great outlash against religion as a cause of conflict. And in response to that outlash, a large group of scholars, who I will, with kind humor, refer to as the Kumbaya School of Religion and Politics, argued that at its core, religion should not be a cause for conflict, that if only we looked deeply into one another's eyes and held hands around the campground, we would discover that we are all sons of Abraham, and there is some other nonsense here about deep human bonds and such. I'm not a member of that school, and if I had been a member, they would have long since confiscated my member card. As you will see, I will suggest that disputes over sacred space are not just difficult to resolve, they are at core impossible to resolve. And I'll say more about that later. The last reason why I'm starting with this anecdote, which doesn't figure large in my book, is to emphasize that in this dispute, as in all the disputes I'll mention today, politics and religion are inextricably intertwined. It is an American tendency, in part because it is a Protestant tendency, to separate religion from politics, to turn religion into some ethereal, abstract, metaphysical issue that need not concern us in everyday life. It's what people do in their privacy of their homes. It's what they do before they go to bed or in their church. It's a relationship between the individual and their deity. That does not hold for most of the humans on this planet for whom religion is a pervasive force. It's a mundane force. It shapes what they eat, what they wear, where they go to school, what supermarkets they shop in, who they can marry, who they can have sex with. It shapes every aspect of their life. It also shapes what they fight over and what options are available for resolution. Separating religion from politics by either suggesting that there is no connection between the two, or that all religious behavior is somehow political behavior, that is, the failure to recognize that there are two forces at play here, is, I'd like to argue, part of the problem as we try to resolve conflicts over sacred space around the world. So here's what I'd like to do in the minutes remaining. I'd like to tell you a little about sacred space, and given what I've just said, I'd like to do that from the point of view of the sociology of religion, which is not something political scientists usually do. That was part of my effort, and continues to be part of my effort, is to step outside my office and outside my department at Berkeley and roam in departments like anthropology, sociology, religious studies, and even theology to teach myself and my political science colleagues about what experts on religion have to say on matters relating to religion and politics. Yes, you can't just study politics when you're trying to resolve disputes about religion and politics. This would be obvious if we were studying disputes about economics and politics. You wouldn't just be studying politics. You'd try to get some knowledge in economics. Or if we were trying to resolve a dispute between educators and politicians, we'd probably want to know something about education. But when it comes to disputes about politics and religion, we're a little wary. So I'll start by dipping a little into the study of religion. Then I'll suggest different reasons why groups fight over sacred space. And then in part three, talk about the indivisibility problem, suggesting that unlike most territory you know, your office, your house, your garden, sacred space cannot be divided to the satisfaction of both parties involved. It is an indivisible good. And I'll try to explain what I mean by that and what the implications are. And then conclude by talking about how these conflicts, if they are impossible to resolve, can at least be mitigated. So here we go. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand if you've ever been to Mecca, because few to none of you will ever have been. Difficult place to go. But if you've seen movies, if you've seen pictures, if you've heard tell of what that experience is like, you will know that this is one of the most fabulous places on the planet. Not only are the human emotions involved in attending a place like this tremendous, the architecture, the mass of people, the rituals involved, the sounds, the noises, the smells, it's an overpowering human experience. These sacred places, here's another. This is the center of the Sikh faith in Amritsar, India. These are among the most glorious places on the planet. They literally take your breath away. If you've been to the Vatican, if you've been to Jerusalem, if you've been to some of the great cathedrals of Europe or some of the great Hindu shrines around the world, you will know what I'm talking about. These are just, this is humanity at its most splendorous. At the same time, there is something terrifying about these places. They are at once both places where humans with a deep emotional commitment believe that they can see the divine, speak to the divine, request favors from the divine. In that sense, these places are tremendously powerful. But at the same time, they're also scary places, in part because the divine has no bounds. The divine is all-powerful. You might make a wrong move. You might offend someone. At worst, you might offend the gods. They are also places in which a constant tension exists between different groups in the business of worship. These are all places rife with bloodshed. These are all places at which violence is constant. And that's the riddle I tried to get at. In part, and this is where this quote at the top of the slide comes from, I found some comfort in the arguments of theologians. This is a German theologian, Rudolf Otto, who suggested that the sacred was a terrifying and fascinating mystery. Terrifying, because it is the ultimate power. Fascinating, because it is what in part, humans yearn to know most about, and it is that tension that creates the experience we call the sacred. And you all know this because you've all heard the story about Moses in the burning bush. And you know the scene where Moses is wandering through the desert and he sees this miraculous apparition, and he hears a voice and he wants to move towards it. He's immediately drawn to it. The Bible leaves no doubt in the mind of the reader that Moses is rushing towards the burning bush. He wants to touch it. He wants to figure out what's going on here. It's amazing and fascinating. But then immediately the command issues. Stop. Come no closer. Take off your shoes. There is a risk of desecration here. That tension exists in all religious movements I studied, because all religious movements recognize sacred time and sacred space, and they all recognize the tension between wanting to be drawn towards the divine and the danger of desecration. And that, I argue, is at the basis of conflicts over sacred spaces. And they exist worldwide, not just in the Middle East, not just in Asia. They exist here in America, in fact, in Northern California, whether it's Mount Shasta, or in Southern California, where there are disputes over burial grounds. In fact, even on the Berkeley campus, there are disputes over alleged burial grounds on which the university was built. The top left black and white image is a shot of the temple lot in Independence, Missouri, in the middle of the city of Independence, Missouri, where, according to Mormon belief, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints believe the second temple will be built upon Christ's return. And so three different Mormon splinter groups are fighting over this empty lot. It's a street corner. There are four lots. Each of the three churches has occupied one lot. The fourth lot is the empty one. And they are threatening, and they are burning down one another's buildings. And these disputes occur everywhere around the globe. Some of these places, I'm sure, will seem familiar to you, and some of them I will actually talk about. Why all this conflict? Let me suggest five basic reasons that I go over in detail in the book. The first, I think, is the one that you all know best. This is conflict between large religious groups who both stake a claim to a site. Muslims and Jews over Jerusalem is the classic example. B is almost more interesting. This is intra-religious conflict. These are members of a religious group that has somehow splintered, who are both trying to capture a sacred site and hold it in order to demonstrate that they are the true successors of the mother church, so to speak. The classic example is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. Here's a map. This map is color-coded to show the different Christian denominations in the church and the parts of the church that are under their control. So there's no dispute over this church, which is supposed to be the site of the crucifixion and resurrection, a very important place in Christianity. There's no Muslim demand over the space. There's no Jewish claim to the space. This is entirely in the hands of Christians. It's the Christians who can't disagree on who should hold to it. There are Catholics, Armenians, Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Copts, these are Egyptian Christians, Ethiopian Christians fighting over every stone and corner in this church. And they have been fighting over it for the last 1,700 years, fighting to such an extent that they cannot agree on renovating the structure. When a wall was removed about 10 years ago and it created a stretch of previously unknown ground that was about 3 inches wide, immediately argument erupted about who controlled that, who was allowed to clean it, who could step on it, what times of the day. A status quo agreement that I wish I'd had here in large form, but maybe those of you with really sharp eyes can see that there are steps here, each one of which is in a different color. Right, so the Copts get to clean the first step, and the Catholics get to clean the second step. There are columns up here, which are three quarters one group, one quarter the other. And God help you, literally, if you clean the wrong part of the column. There are nuns chasing priests with candlesticks. There are deacons stabbing archbishops in the thigh with knives. There is bloodshed. People are getting beaten to death over different corners of this church. And I can offer many other examples if you're curious. Sacred space is real estate. Anybody know where this is? Have you seen this before? If you're a Steven Spielberg fan, you might have seen it before. Close Encounters. This is Devil's Tower. And here, the conflict is not between two religious groups. It's between a religious group and a secular group. The secular group, in this case, mountain climbers, has absolutely no religious stake in the dispute. They just want to climb Devil's Tower. It's the Dakota Indians who say, no, you can't climb this tower. This is our sacred mountain. We don't climb it. Nobody's allowed to climb it. Climbing it, touching it, amounts to desecration. To which, of course, the mountain climbers, being very sensitive liberal granola types, say, okay, then we'll only climb it every other weekend. No, you can't. This is sacred space. How about 4 days a year? No, you don't get it. You can't ever. Never climb it. This is the indivisibility problem that I'll get to again in a minute. There is no room for negotiation here. There's no room for compromise from the point of view of somebody who thinks that there are very clear religious rules that cannot be transgressed. Issue D, sacred space as a force multiplier, is something that we are rather new to. As Americans, others around the world have encountered this before us. Here, the conflict is not necessarily about the sacred space, but it happens to take place in or near a sacred space. So you envision a Marine troop chasing insurgents. The insurgents are outnumbered and outgunned, and so they find refuge in a mosque. Now what do you do? That's hence the term force multiplier. The insurgents can now match their strength with the Marines because the Americans are, of course, doubly worried about damaging the mosque. The insurgents have an easier time. They're shooting from the mosque out. It's very easy to not damage a building when you're on the inside shooting out. It's much harder for those on the outside shooting in. And, of course, the insurgents happen to have the same religious affiliation that the mosque-goers have. It's the Americans who are infidels. So this puts a tremendous difficulty on the shoulders of U.S. decision-makers who have at times decided to just give up the pursuit, at other times have gone to the other extreme and just bombed the mosque to smithereens, and all sorts of combinations in between, including, as you see here, suggesting that Marines remove their shoes in hot pursuit as they're chasing insurgents. There's really no easy answer to this. This has happened elsewhere in the world. The Indo-Pakistani dispute is another common case. It was a very interesting case in Israel about a decade ago in which Israeli soldiers chasing Muslim Palestinian militants in Bethlehem, and those Muslim Palestinian militants found refuge in the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. So now you've got the Jews on the outside, the Muslims on the inside, in a church. Whose rules apply? How do you navigate this minefield? Not an easy problem. I'll suggest towards the end of my talk that this minefield cannot be navigated without religious expertise. You need to talk to somebody who knows what the rules are. And finally, sacred space as a social symbol. This is one of the saddest byproducts of the current sectarian conflict in Iraq, since sacred space is often the most valued site for a religious group. Opponents know that by hitting sacred space, they hit where it hurts the most. And if you're an insurgent, and if your goal, among other things, is to provoke conflict and provoke an overreaction, what better way to do this than to attack your opponent's sacred site, if possible, on a holy day? So this is both a place in which people congregate, a lot of them are going to get hurt, but you're also hurting the religious group where it hurts the most. Okay, so what's the problem here? Why can't we just deal with these conflicts the way we would deal with conflicts over schools and libraries or territories? Why can't we just find some sort of compromise, some sort of division? I'd like to suggest that the problem is a problem of indivisibility. Sacred places, like babies, are indivisible. There's no way to cut them in a way that will please both parents. Take, for example, this particularly good-looking baby, if I may say so myself. There is no compromise open to me or my wife when it comes to dividing this baby up. We might. It'll never happen, God willing. But we might, should it come to divorce, agree on dividing time with our children. That's what paternity disputes are about. They're not about the body of the children. They're about time spent with the children. But when it comes to the body itself, there's no room for compromise. Were you to offer me, and I dare you to, $1 million for my daughter's left thigh, I would say no. And you could start going up, $2 million, $4 million. No, 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 it's not going to happen. How about for her pinky? No. How about for this top part of her pinky? Absolutely not. Nothing. Right? Why? Because she's only of use to me as an integral whole. There's no substitute for her. She's non-fungible. She can't be translated into money. The same, I'd like to suggest, is true of sacred space. This is the prime example, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, which takes up a couple of chapters in the book. It has, first of all, perfectly rigid boundaries, which is the first requirement for something to be indivisible. There is no bargaining here over where my daughter starts and ends. Yes, I mean all 10 fingers. Yes, both eyes, all the toes, please. The same is true for Jerusalem. Muslims and Jews are in perfect agreement as to where the Temple Mount is. You can't fudge this by saying, you hold on to your Temple Mount, and I'll have my Temple Mount over there. No, the two overlap, and they overlap beautifully and perfectly. They have to, the boundaries have to be rigidly defined, because your behavior has to change as you enter the space. The problem is desecration. Because there is a concern about desecration, I need to know exactly where it is that I take off my shoes, or put on my skull cap, or if it's a Shinto temple, wash out my mouth, or if it's a church, put on my hat, right? I need to know exactly where the sacred space begins and ends. Second, the content of sacred sites is perfectly coherent. All their parts hang together. This is true even for some of the larger temple complexes in India or Japan. It's true for some of the greatest cathedrals in the world. They seem to be made up of different parts. But a church ceases to function as a church if you remove one of these parts All these parts contribute to the function of the whole. Take away a part, it's like taking away my daughter's thigh. She's no good to me. And finally, and most obviously, irreplaceable value. No money in the world offered to Jews or Muslims will compensate them for the loss of their primary access to God. No sum in the world. Hence, sacred space is indivisible. There is no way to divide it to the satisfaction of the parties. Not difficult to divide. No room for compromise. This was not at all obvious to political leaders negotiating over sacred space, be it these three guys who tried to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, only to discover that refugees weren't the big issue. Borders, weapons, water, those weren't the big issues. What brought down the Camp David discussions in the year 2000 was the issue of Jerusalem, and specifically the issue of the Temple Mount. And the parties going to Camp David were stunned about this. They never consulted religious leaders. They never consulted religious experts. They had no idea what they were bargaining over. And as they sat down and suggested a series of bargains that fell through one by one by one, it slowly dawned upon them that they weren't bargaining over the same kind of territory that is your front lawn or Miami. This was special territory. This was more like bargaining over Gettysburg or the White House lawn. There was something about this territory that made it particularly difficult to bargain over. By the time they realized this, it was too late. Similarly, members of the Indian government, members of Australia's government, as they tried to negotiate with Aborigines in Australia, time and time again, fall into the trap of treating these territories as if they were just land. How do you divide land? Easy. You get a pencil, you get a ruler, start dividing. You start offering money across the table. That will not work with sacred space. You cannot treat this as if it were a simple political dispute. You have to understand the religious aspects. That was not the case with Ehud Barak here on the side, Israel's prime minister at the time, who was so ignorant of his own constituency's demands that he, among other things, demanded that the Palestinians allow the construction of a synagogue in the Temple Mount, which is something no Jew in his right mind would ever demand. Yasser Arafat, representing the Palestinians, among other things, rejected any Jewish link to Jerusalem or the Temple Mount, which is incoherent from a Muslim point of view. Had he studied his Quran, he would have understood that the Jewish valuing of the Temple Mount rests, among other things, on the claim that Islam is the true inheritor of the Jewish tradition. That's why Jerusalem is sacred to Muslims and Christians, because it was sacred to Jews first, right? It was just unknown to him, and so they all blundered. Clinton blundered too, and I can give some examples of that. So how might you use religion in the service of mitigating disputes over sacred space? I have 5 minutes, so I'll give you a brief example. This is an example from 1967, when the state of Israel expanded dramatically during the Six-Day War to occupy what is now known as the West Bank. And in the West Bank were sites sacred to Jews that they had been barred from for several thousands of years. These were sites sacred to both Muslims and Jews. And so it became obvious to Israel's political leaders that as soon as these sites would be liberated in the name of the State of Israel, Jews would want to start worshiping there again with particular enthusiasm, having been barred from there for centuries, and that conflict would ensue. And that's exactly what happened at the Tomb of Joseph, which is in Samaria at the top, the Tomb of Rachel, which is just outside Bethlehem, and the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron. To this day, violence was constant and high from the moment these places were opened to worship of both Jews and Muslims. So there was even greater concern, of course, regarding the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, a much larger site, a much more important site, a site that doesn't sit somewhere out in the countryside, but is embedded in the middle of the old city of Jerusalem, with 11 gates leading from the city into the compound. It would take an army to guard this site, but it would be impossible to bar either Jews or Muslims from it, because both claimed and both, in fact, had the right to pray there. So the assumption was that if in a place like Rachel's tomb, which is about half the size of this room, violence was constant, then in a space like this, which is 30 acres in size, the bloodshed would be out of control. And yet not a single person was wounded, let alone killed, on the Temple Mount. in the first almost 20 years of its liberation by Israeli soldiers. This was odd. This is what, in part, started me off on this project. What happened? How was peace kept on the Temple Mount for 20 years, and why did it stop after 20 years? The answer was that as soon as the Temple Mount became available to Jewish access, leading rabbis in Israel and around the world started thinking hard about what this meant for Judaism. How would Jews enter this space? This used to be the site of the Jewish temple, the most holy place on earth to Jews, a place where God quite literally resided. God's essence lived in the temple, in the Holy of Holies, which was a place of extreme danger to which only the high priest could enter once a year on Yom Kippur to quickly utter benedictions and then quickly withdraw because it was a place of tremendous force. How would Jews enter this place? What rites of purification would they use? Would they renew the same ritual sacrifices that they used to practice 2,000 years ago? What the rabbis decided after a long conference was that the Temple Mount was so holy to Jews that they were not allowed to enter, ever. And so this young lad was placed in a little hut at the entrance of the Temple Mount with a sign that says, I don't know if you can read it in the back, but in English it says, according to Jewish law, it is strictly forbidden for anybody to enter the Temple Mount owing to its sanctity. And here is the same in one of many Hebrew posters that were put up that essentially said, you will be excommunicated and struck down by the hand of God if you even set foot in the Temple Mount, because you will be committing a sacrilege. Now think about how ingenious this is. It doesn't bar all Jews from entering the Temple Mount. I can tell you firsthand. I've been on the Temple Mount. I'm Jewish. Why? I don't care. I'm not too worried about what rabbis think might happen to me. I'm not that much of a believer. So the prohibition did not stop relatively secular, relatively liberal Jews from entering the Temple Mount, many of whom continue to do so today as tourists. It was believing Jews. It was precisely the population that was most likely to come into friction with Muslims on the Temple Mount, not because they would seek conflict, but because they would be practicing contradictory rituals on the Temple Mount, that was barred from accessing the Temple Mount due to this rabbinical ruling. It required 300 rabbis to sign the agreement. That is why it held. Judaism, unlike Catholicism, is not a hierarchical religious movement, so there is no person at the top who can issue instructions that everybody has to follow. In the case of Judaism, it's almost like vote by majority. When 300 leading rabbis tell you that this is prohibited, then you, as a believing Jew, don't do it. So why were no Jews and Muslims hurt on the Temple Mount in the first 20 years after its occupation? Because there weren't any Jews on the Temple Mount. No Jews of significance on the Temple Mount in those first 20 years. Only later then did a generation of young rabbis come that started issuing counter-rulings. And these counter-rulings then started a flow of Jews onto the Temple Mount, and then, of course, conflict immediately. So what are we to learn from this? And I will conclude. First of all, you don't want to be the Pope. You see him saying, oy vey. This is Akrima Sabri. He was, at the time when this photo was taken, the chief representative Muslim cleric of the Palestinian Authority. And this is one of the chief rabbis of Israel there on the other side. You cannot resolve conflicts over sacred space by ignoring the religious component, which is sort of our instinct as Protestant Americans. Religion complicates things. Just leave it out of the picture. You need religious intelligence. You need information. So there are three reasons why you might want to consult with religious experts like, I don't know, me. First, knowledge, information. What are the boundaries of this site? Which parts are more important? Which parts are less important? What are rituals associated with it? What might cause the maximum or minimum transgression? How can I execute policing or military operations without causing too much offense? And how can I make reparations for offense if I cause it? So number one, just plain information. You don't have to talk to a rabbi to find this out. You just have to talk to smart people. But if you can get hold of a religious leader, that opens up a whole world of possibilities, because religious leaders make and unmake sacred space at a daily level. Think about this. Every time a new cemetery has to be set up, you take a piece of land that is unholy and you turn it holy by inviting a cleric to sanctify it by means of incantations and rituals and sprinkling of stuff and walking around it and putting up fences and all sorts of tools that only religious leaders have. I cannot turn a secular site into a sacred site. I don't have the charisma. I don't have the knowledge to do that. If religious leaders can make sacred sites, and they often unmake them whenever a cemetery has to be removed for the construction of a highway, or a church is no longer safe and has to be dismantled, there are de-sacralization ceremonies that are clearly prescribed in all religious movements. You talk to these people. If you get them to cooperate, which is not always easy and can be costly, they can help you shift the boundaries of sacred space sometimes. They can introduce an element of some flexibility of what might otherwise be an indivisible situation. They might open a small bargaining range. They might not be able to resolve the dispute, but they could, like the rabbis in Jerusalem, suspend the dispute for 10, 20 years. And I'll say a last thing. If you ignore religious leaders, if you leave them out of the picture, they can use their power against you. You cannot resolve a religious dispute and in the process ignore religious leaders and their constituents. You have to pay some sort of homage to them. So at least pretend like you're consulting them. That was one of the problems at Camp David and at similar negotiations. Religious leaders who were sidelined and were thus insulted acted from the outside to torpedo any agreement before it was even published. So that's the third and final conclusion. And it all fits, at least in my mind, together into a larger picture about how the study and understanding of conflicts that involve religion and politics requires two sets of tools. And it's only by combining them that you can be smart about resolving religious disputes. That's me.
Thank you, Ron Hessner, for a very interesting presentation and for joining me at the table to respond to questions. But you started out saying you were pessimistic about the resolution primarily because of the indivisibility. So does it make any sense to get these religious leaders involved if we can't resolve the issues anyhow?
Yeah, what's the point of paying the price of negotiating with a religious leader? And the price can be very high if you can't resolve the dispute. Well, you might not aim for resolving if you can hope to manage or somehow mitigate. You can control levels of violence. The dispute between Christian groups over the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, for example, is kept under wraps to some degree by the fact that the State of Israel, which is the policing authority in Jerusalem, is in constant negotiation with representatives of all these churches and consults them at the regular level. They feel they have a stake. They feel that they're being overseen and being listened to. And so when things get out of control, there are mechanisms in place to manage the dispute. We have no such mechanisms in place in the United States to deal with, for example, conflicts involving Islam. Our government does not know any Muslims. This was painfully apparent in the aftermath of September 11th when George Bush tried to organize a religion fest in the White House. This was September 12th or 13th, inviting, I think, 30-some clerics from around the United States to show sort of unity. And there were 15 Protestants and four rabbis, you know, one of each type, and various representatives of Hinduism and Shintoism, and not a single Muslim, because the government didn't know who to invite. Who do you talk to? That's just incomprehensible to me. We have to at least have in place mechanisms for dialogue. We have to know who represents Muslims of the Bay Area. It's not going to be one person because, again, it's not a hierarchical structure. But who speaks for them? From whom can we learn what's been transgressed here, what the rules are, what insult was caused, how insult can be prevented? Who might we use, this is taking it a step further, to influence? Right? We know who to talk to when we have an issue with the Catholic community in the United States or around the world. We know who to talk to when we have an issue with the Jewish community around the world. But as we're entering into the Middle East, Iraq, Afghanistan, anywhere else, and starting to step on people's toes, it would be nice to have a series of contacts with the Muslim world. Not just the Arab world, not secular leaders only, but also religious leaders. Who do we apologize to after we bomb a mosque? How do we find out that this is a good day to attack if you have to attack? Right? Be good if somebody said, don't do it on a Friday.
right? Or next month is Ramadan. You might want to get it over with before then. This is useful information. To do that, I think, it would be worth paying the price.
Aren't there some other prices? Aren't you, number one, likely to get very, to put it mildly, strong feelings from the religious representatives? Aren't they likely to bring emotions rather than information into the discussion? And secondly, one who is represented, representing a religion, is also likely to be seen over a period of time as a turncoat, someone who is, in fact, going to be the public relations person for you, the political person.
Yeah, those are both very good points. I don't think they are much different than the government, say, negotiating with unions. Yes, union leaders will bring emotions to the table. Now, those emotions are there to begin with. They're not created at the table. It would be good to know about them. It is, in fact, dangerous to assume that these disputes don't involve emotions because I see no emotions at the table. The emotions are there. I think it would be to our advantage to learn about the source of those emotions. This is not to suggest that you want to bring the most radical cleric to the table. You want to bring a cleric who recognizes the negotiations as legitimate, recognizes you as legitimate in some way. A cleric who wishes to see a positive end to the conflict, as opposed to a cleric who benefits from the continuation of the conflict. There are many of those. And you want to learn about the emotions. That's exactly why they're there. Why are people upset? What am I doing wrong? How might I make you less upset? Are there some symbolic gestures that might not be expensive at all? The problem of the turncoat is a big problem. This is the blowback problem. And I describe in the book the relationships that the Egyptian government, the Saudi government, have established with their religious elite, the ulamas. These are the wisest Muslim leaders in Egypt and Saudi Arabia. They are, in essence, in the pockets of the Egyptian and Saudi governments, which, at least initially, was very, very useful and helped resolve many a dispute over sacred space. Of course, both sides have to manage that relationship carefully. It has to be clear that the religious rulings issued by these clerics are valid. They're not just the result of bribes. They have some legitimacy. It also has to be clear that the government hasn't sold out to the clerics. Over time, those relationships were eroded, and they are now pretty useless. So today, when Al-Azhar University, which essentially represents the Egyptians' religious elite, issues a ruling saying, we hereby rule that the alliance between Egypt and the United States is acceptable, everybody in the Arab world goes, yeah, of course you do. We know who pays your salary. In fact, we know who nominated you for your position as head of Al-Azhar. It was the Egyptian president. That's the way it works. So they've eroded. They've let that relationship slip. You have to be cautious. Both the government and the cleric have to be careful to maintain their neutrality and their position. But they have to talk. They can't just ignore one another's existence. Madeleine Albright says this in her book, The Mighty and the Almighty, which I think is her third autobiography. She says, during my time at the State Department, when I encountered a legal problem, I went to the legal expert in the State Department. And if I encountered a trade dispute, I went to my trade experts in the State Department. And I had language experts and I had regional experts. But when I ran into a problem involving religion, there was nobody for me to talk to in the State Department. The State Department to this day does not have experts on any religion on its pay. Nobody to talk to. And that seems to me unwise.
I want to encourage any of you to present questions to the council staff. We would love to have your what's especially of interest to you. In the meantime, I'll ask some of the questions that have come up and may fill in with some of my own. Just going to continue along this same line and ask if there were religious advisors at Camp David, what kind of different solution might have been suggested?
Oh, that's a very good question. I have no idea. Because I'm
Next
always,
question.
Because I'm always surprised when the solution comes. I mean, who would have thought that the way to prevent conflict between Jews and Muslims on the Temple Mount in 67 was to bar all Jews from entering? That's crazy. And then, in fact, tell Jews that that's always been the case. Oh, Jews were never allowed on the Temple Mount, which is nonsense. Historically speaking, just complete nonsense. But it worked. And, in fact, works to some extent to this day. So let me give you an example of a solution, two solutions that were absolutely brilliant at Camp David. that didn't fly because they came out of the wrong mouth. The first was a solution proposed by Bill Clinton, smart man, who said, look, we've got this platform, 30 acres large, and the different groups are disputing different parts of it, and there's perfect overlap between the parts they're disputing. But primarily, the Muslims want access to their shrines, which are on the top, and the Jews want access to the history of the platform, which is underneath. So instead of cutting up the platform this way, could we perhaps cut it up this way? There's an ingenious way of cutting a cake, right? Try this next time it's your birthday. Instead of cutting it this way, cut it that way.
I want the icing.
Yes, that's right. Muslims get the icing, Jews get the ruins underneath. Would have been an ingenious solution were it not for two things. First, this solution fails the test of Jewish theology. In Jewish understanding of sanctity, sanctity is vertical. That's actually quite common for most religious groups. Sanctity is a connection between the earth and the heavens, right? So if you have, as a Jew, if you have a problem of stepping onto the Temple Mount, you also have a problem of crawling under the Temple Mount or flying over the Temple Mount in a helicopter, which is, in fact, a big problem for Jews. You can't do this. You can't sever that link between earth and heaven. That problem, I think, could have been addressed were it not for a second problem. And I'm putting words here in the mouth of most Orthodox Jews in Israel. Who's Bill Clinton? Why do I care about what some American guy proposes as a solution for the Temple Mount? I've never heard of him. Is he a famous rabbi? Does he understand Jewish laws? Does he understand our relationship? In other words, Bill Clinton has zero authority over the Jewish community. He has no what Max Weber would have called charisma. You need a rabbi to do that. So the solution may be ingenious, but it's coming from the wrong person. The second solution, which was offered by the most renowned professor of international law in Israel, Professor Ruth Lapidot, said, I have the solution. Sovereignty over the Temple Mount should not be in the hands of the Palestinians or the Israelis. It should be in the hands of God. That's just genius. That's really smart, because look, we can figure out functional sovereignty, is what she said. We can figure out who cleans which part, and who does the policing, and who does, you know, the maintenance work. That's not what they're fighting over here. They're fighting over who does it belong to. So why don't we just say, it doesn't belong to you or you. It belongs to God. It's a sacred site. Again, an ingenious solution, but who's Ruth Lapidot? Who is this woman? Is she an important imam? Does she have sway over the Muslim community in Palestine? She doesn't. Right? So these solutions have to come from religious leaders in order to work, and I suspect religious leaders could have come up with a lot of other ingenious solutions that I can't even think of.
You said, I think, in your talk that Jerusalem was liberated in 1967, but couldn't people make the argument that these religious sites in Jerusalem are currently occupied, not liberated, and many Muslims are barred today from praying at various sites, at Al-Aqsa perhaps?
Yeah, the language is extremely difficult. So throughout the book and other articles I've published, I've been very careful to go back and forth and not refer to the Temple Mount as the Temple Mount, but sometimes as the Temple Mount, and sometimes as Harabait, which is what Jews call it, and sometimes as the Haram Sharif, which is what Muslims call it, so that nobody gets offended, because in part, at Camp David, at one highlight, Yasser Arafat stormed out of the room because Madeleine Albright dared refer to the site as the Temple Mount. That was enough to anger him to such an extent that he sort of stormed out of the room. And similarly, I've been very careful throughout the talk, those of you who have recorded it can go back and check, to go back and forth between occupied and liberated and occupied, and conquered, which is the third word, so as to at least insult everybody in the audience equally. That's always my goal. There's no way around this. My reference to the Six-Day War as the Six-Day War, as opposed to the June War, already gave away that I, to some extent, buy more into the American-Israeli narrative than the other one. Similarly, if you say Yom Kippur War as opposed to October War, everybody immediately knows who you are and who you're not. So this is dangerous stuff. As far as rights go, again, a very touchy issue. At least formally, there is freedom of worship in Israel today. There was not, by the way, before 1967. That is, before 1967, contrary to agreements between Israel and Jordan, no non-Muslims were allowed in the Temple Mount. In fact, Jews were not even allowed access to Jewish sites like the Western Wall. Most sacred places in Israel today are open to worship unless the people who go there intend to do harm. And so often, Muslims between age 18 and 30 or 35 of particular background are barred when tensions are high. Since then, in fact, the opposite has happened. Because the Israeli government made a decision early on, backed by the rabbinical declaration that I told you about, to hand physical control over the Temple Mount over to the Palestinians, it's the Palestinians who have barred tourists, and in fact anybody who's not Muslim, from entering the Temple Mount, so that in my five last attempts of entering the Temple Mount, I've been unable to do so. I've walked towards it, and I have the right to visit as a tourist. I have no intention of doing harm. And a Palestinian dude, a member of the Palestinian religious authority overseeing the mount, said, "You may not enter. I don't want you coming in here." At which point, I look over to the Israeli policeman standing at the site, whose job it is to enforce freedom of the right to free access to the site, and then thought, oh, maybe this isn't such a good idea. You know, the third intifada would then be called the Hassner Intifada. I'm not sure that this is good PR, necessarily. In fact, the Palestinians have been very, very good at slowly expanding their control over the Temple Mount further and further and further out, until today it is almost impossible for a tourist to go into the Muslim shrines, even though by Israeli law they should be allowed to do so. So as a rule, there is free access. At times of tension, all access is barred, but that happens across sacred sites.
You started out talking about the Native American conflict. You discussed in significant detail the conflict in Jerusalem. Could you use some other examples of sites that are considered sacred by more than one religion, Judea or others?
Yes. Appropriate? Well, sadly, there isn't a sacred site of importance on this planet that is not now or hasn't been in the recent past a source of conflict. It's hard to think of an exception, because as soon as a site becomes that important and that sacred, it's a resource. It's an easy, fast way to have your dreams fulfilled, receive healing, see God. Who's not going to fight over this? And the fighting may start off as benign, but eventually, because of the indivisibility problem, will quickly deteriorate into violence. So a classic example you mentioned is the conflict in Ayodhya between Muslims and Hindus, which is sort of a very interesting parallel to the dispute over Jerusalem and the Haram al-Sharif. There in Ayodhya, it is the claim by Hindus that Muslims built a mosque of theirs on top of what used to be a Hindu temple, and not just any Hindu temple, but the Hindu temple that commemorates the birthplace of the god Ram. Now, this happens to be untrue, archaeologically speaking. But that's not of particular importance here. And in fact, there's plenty of precedent for the destruction of Hindu sites by invading Muslims throughout India. Thousands of examples. So this claim is not entirely, fictitious, although it happens in this particular case to be untrue. This dispute was mismanaged to such an extent by attempts by India's political leadership to divide the site as if it were a secular site. Put up a fence, oh, let's take turns praying here, barring one group, then barring the other group, which of course never works. One group always ends up dissatisfied, until in the end, at the climax in 1992, thousands of Hindu extremists demolished the mosque with their bare hands. This mosque was a two-story concrete structure. They demolished it with their bare hands in 14 hours. Which then led to riots, anti-Muslim riots, anti-Hindu riots, the largest communal rioting in India since the partition, with tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of dead. You have these disputes here in California. Calpine, a California energy company, has been at dispute with the Pitt River tribe right next to Mount Shasta now for the last 5 years. Calpine had planned to build one of America's greatest green energy plants by deriving energy, sort of seismic energy, from a volcanic area next to Mount Shasta. And then the Pitt River tribe showed up and said, that volcanic energy you're tapping, that's God. Please don't tap it. And in fact, they didn't even use the word please. They said that they would do everything in their power to stop it, and Calpine has been sort of at an impasse with them ever since. Latin American examples abound. The only cases really where no conflict exists, even though you'd expect there to be conflict, is where one group has simply annihilated the other group completely. So you find no disputes over most Christian sites in Latin America today, even though most of these Christian sites are placed on top of native sites because the natives are gone. They've been exterminated. Right? So one side wins outright, and then there's no dispute. There is no dispute over the many churches in Spain today, particularly southern Spain, that used to be mosques because the Muslims of Spain have been driven out. There is no Muslim constituency left to protest this, and one might speculate that if there should ever be such a constituency, conflict will resume. So any corner on this planet is rife with this, which is what makes it both tragic and, for me, wonderful.
You talked about politicians or diplomats essentially using conferring with religious leaders. To what extent is a politician who has strong religious credentials through his involvement in a religion as a member or someone who prays frequently, a more useful diplomat than one who doesn't have these credentials?
That's a very good question. I haven't thought about that much. You would think that such a person, if they happen to have an expertise, an affiliation with one of the religions involved in the conflict, would be useful, but then again, that would create even more mistrust by the other party, which he is not affiliated with. So a pretty good prescription, actually, for mitigating these disputes is to be neutral. One reason why the State of Israel manages to maintain relative calm at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is because it's a Jewish state. And so it's clear that it doesn't favor the Catholics over the Copts or the Copts over the Greek Orthodox. Right? It's a relatively neutral party. One of the reasons why the Indian government failed to prevent conflict at Ayodhya, and in fact we now learn may have had a hand in the conflict in Ayodhya, is because even though India is a secular state, it is run by primarily Hindus. And those Hindus were not neutral towards the Hindu-Muslim dispute. A relatively interesting example, which I haven't thought about enough, one of Christianity's most sacred sites, which is also a Muslim sacred site, is the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul. And that is not a site of conflict because the Turkish government under Ataturk was, again, neutral. It was radically secular, in fact, anti-religiously secular, and took this potential site of conflict and turned it into a museum and said, nobody's praying here. That would not have worked, I think, had the government been either a majority Muslim or a majority Christian government, because the Muslims would have then said, yeah, but when you say nobody can pray, you don't mean us, right, buddy? Because, you know, we're in this together. So just every other Friday, you can just let us in through the side door. No, this was a government that had both the overwhelming force and the neutral position to say, look, fellas, you stay out of this, and we're going to clamp down and make sure that no conflict erupts here. So if anything, I prefer neutrality over that sort of immersion.
In South Africa, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was led, and it was lent great credibility by the leadership of Archbishop Tutu. And he based his work on Judeo-Christian ethics. The question is, could this model be adapted for Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist conflicts as well?
Very good. So now we're slipping into the Kumbaya school of religion and politics. And so let me say something in defense of that school, because it is worth pointing out its strengths. There is this argument out there, made most provocatively in a book called Religion, the Missing Dimension of Statecraft. Imagine this. Religion, the missing dimension of statecraft. What we need in statecraft is more religion. The argument there was that religious leaders can very often act as third parties to a dispute, not, as in my story, because they are experts and insiders on one of the parties involved, but because they are neutral to both parties involved. They come in as outsiders. So, for example, a Catholic movement, the Church of San Egidio, which is in part sponsored by the Vatican, has sent its priests all over the world to act as intermediaries, as third parties, in conflicts that don't involve Christians. Civil wars in Africa, civil wars in Asia, where two groups, they could be native religions, they could be Muslims versus Muslims, they could be, you know, any religious group you can imagine, have a problem resolving a dispute, and in comes this cleric who is a man of God. He is clearly not to be bribed. He is clearly not motivated by self-aggrandizement or greed. His only motivation, if he's the right guy, in the case of Desmond Tutu, he's the right guy, is to make the world a better place. And very often, Sierra Leone, originally in Darfur, these religious leaders were able to make the peace. They can do this under very, very limited conditions. You have to find the right leaders. They have to be very courageous. They have to be selfless. And then they can do this. They are not quite as helpful in disputes over sacred space. So yes, perhaps one could call on a Catholic to help broker the dispute between Jews and Muslims over Jerusalem. But the Catholic also has a certain interest. So perhaps a Hindu priest would be appropriate. But where do you find a Hindu priest who's willing to walk into that mess in Jerusalem? Right? Probably say, I'd rather not.
All right. Well, this is the last question because we've run out of time. But the same kind of issue. You mentioned that Hillary Clinton really felt a lack of having religious advice in the State Department. Of what religion should that person be who was hired by Hillary Clinton?
He doesn't need to be a religious cleric at all. He can just be a religious expert. It would help if it were someone who took, say, intro to religion. Somebody who was religiously literate, right? So when the experts that I have today in the State Department who advise on matters of international law aren't necessarily members of the United Nations or members of the International Court in The Hague. You just have to be people trained, people who know something about this. So again, at the basic level, this just needs to be somebody who is well-read in religion. Yes, you'd need more than one person. You'd need, presumably somebody who knows something about religions of concern, which would be, for example, Eastern Christianity. Right? I think we know a good deal about Western Christianity. We don't know much about Orthodox Christianity. It would help to have somebody on board who is an expert in Asian religions, and there are many of those. Many, many of those. Staff two or three right there. But, you know, how many people do we have today in the State Department who are experts on Asia? Probably a good 24. So what would be the problem in having 5 or 6 folks in the State Department who, among other things, in addition to their expertise in language and in law and in geography, also have an expertise in Islam, Buddhism, Confucianism, Shintoism? I don't think they would have to be of any religious persuasion. They would just have to know their stuff.
You make a good argument. And this concludes our program. On behalf of the World Affairs Council's Young Professional International Forum, I want to ask the audience to join me in thanking Ron Hasner. He really has made a fine presentation, and I think he answered the questions brilliantly. He has agreed to stay a little while and sign copies of War on Sacred Ground. I encourage all of you to take advantage of the opportunity. Thank you very much, Ron Hasner.
Thank you.